Kelly, you grew up in the 80s like I did. You went to the mall a lot, right?
Yeah. What else are you going to do when you're 13?
Well, these days there seem to be other options. And if you and I were buying things and getting entertainment at the mall in the 80s, nowadays people seem to be able to do both of those things on the internet or on mobile phones. But American malls, while this seems like a problem for them, are not taking this lightly. They are fighting back. And this is the latest in our series on malls that we're producing with our colleagues at Youth Radio. Here's NPR's Sonari Glinton.
Here's a question. What is a shopping mall? For our answer, we turn to those shopping mall experts of yesteryear, the Latin boy band Menudo.
If there's anything you need, you can always find it in a shopping mall.
Okay, that Menudo clip points to the importance of entertainment at the shopping mall. Stick with me, we'll get to that later. But first, let's get the real definition of a mall from Tad Phillip. He researches the companies that own shopping malls for Moody's.
Malls are typically enclosed, anchored by department stores, often in an X shape with a department store on each end and inline stores connecting them.
That's the traditional mall. So if you're a mall owner, what you do is provide traffic for tenants. It's essentially, you pay me, I bring you the customers. One of the ways to make sure you get customers, though, is to have one of those big national retailers. But now mall owners are finding new ways to draw shoppers. So through the magic of radio, I'm here standing in the middle of The Grove, which is a shopping center in Los Angeles, and I'm with Anthony Dukes. He's a professor at the University of Southern California. Help me describe to people what makes this place special.
Well, at the Grove, you have this outdoor shopping environment with well-manicured gardens and plants and water fountains. It has the feel of an old main street with the train tracks and the toy train that goes up and down, street lights.
The Grove opened about a dozen years ago, and it's kind of a mashup of a bunch of things. Mall, town square, park. It's not really a full-bore mall. And Duke says the Grove is proof that the death of the mall is exaggerated.
It's tempting to portray the internet as changing everything about retail, and it has had a profound effect. But there are certain things that internet doesn't change, and that's convenience, the experience of shopping, and then the physical interaction with a product or sales expertise.
Malls are no longer about the distribution of goods.
That's Tad Phillip of Moody's.
That's where you went to pick up your jeans or your shoes or your books. And some categories have been entirely replaced by online. Others are substantially emplaced. So you need something to draw you to the mall, something that's not available online. And in many cases, it's as simple as seeing other people and strolling.
Phillip's colleague Mary Frankel says you can see the shift in malls towards experiences. She says there was a time when the only food you found at the mall was in a food court.
I don't think you will see malls where you don't have a myriad of restaurants, maybe a movie theater. More and more shopping centers are including gyms as well as medical facilities. Basically, things that you do not get online and will draw you into the center.
Now, the food is often as big a draw as a big-name retailer. And it's not enough to have Menudo perform once at your mall. The Grove, for instance, has almost brought back vaudeville because they have so many acts performing there. Phillip says not all the malls will be able to make it if they have to be one-stop entertainment. He says malls aren't dying, but don't expect explosive growth.
I don't see an explosion of mall growth anytime soon. I think there will be opportunities here and there for new malls, but I think largely the country is built out for all the malls it needs.
It's not just about the internet, but changing tastes. It's a bit much to expect our retail lives to be cemented in bricks and mortar while the world changes all around.
In many cases, the mall has replaced the downtown. And in some cases now, the internet is doing to the mall what the mall did to downtown. So a little bit of creative destruction.
Downtown survived the mall, and the mall will survive the internet. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
There's been a big debate at the Federal Reserve about when to begin raising its closely watched interest rate. That debate continued at the Fed's most recent meeting late last month. Minutes from that meeting are out, and they have some things to tell us. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The most recent forecast from Fed officials suggests the first rate hike is likely to come sometime in the second half of next year. But former Fed Governor Randall Krosner says minutes of the Fed's recent meeting show a number of officials believe the central bank should begin raising rates sooner.
Some Fed members believe that there's not very much slack in the economy. The unemployment rate is coming down, and that we need to move quickly.
But the minutes also reveal that a majority of policymakers, including Fed Chair Janet Yellen, are looking beyond improvements in the unemployment rate and believe the labor market still needs the Fed's help.
Janet Yellen is focusing on long-term unemployed, the people who are part-time workers who prefer to be full-time, looking at the very low level of labor force participation. And looking at those factors suggests that there's still a long way to go for the labor market to recover.
So far, subdued inflation has allowed the Fed to continue its stimulative low interest rate policy. But Krosner cautions that inflation can become a threat quickly in an improving economy. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
Now, officials from the Fed are gathering again today, along with some of their foreign counterparts. They are attending Kansas City Fed's annual symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And for a preview, we turn, as we often do, to David Wessel of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal. David, great to talk to you again.
Good morning.
So you've covered the Fed's Jackson Hole conference many times before. It gets a lot of attention. Is that just because it's this gorgeous mountain spot?
Yes, that's definitely part
okay,
of it.
Good.
It's easier to get people to go to the Grand Tetons in August than to, say, a ballroom in Manhattan.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And the TV cameras just love the backdrop, you know, a dull-looking Federal Reserve official with the mountains in the background. It's also very exclusive. You have to be invited. The formal sessions are not live-streamed or broadcast, so if you're not in the room, you can't know what's going on. And on top of that, the conference has in the past been the venue for some very influential academic papers. And importantly, during the financial crisis, Ben Bernanke, then the Fed chairman, used it as a forum to send some pretty important messages about the direction of monetary policy. Now, this year, the focus is on the job market. Janet Yellen, the new Fed chair, is going to talk about that tomorrow morning. But there may actually be more attention on what Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, has to say, given the latest round of disappointing economic news from Europe.
Okay, given that context and given that jobs are big on the economic agenda, what exactly are central bankers focusing on right now?
Well, even the titles of the papers and the academics who are giving them are embargoed until tonight.
Huh.
Somehow, this new Fed transparency hasn't quite penetrated the Kansas City Fed yet. But there are a couple of salient issues. There's a lot of debate about how much damage the Great Recession did to the job market and to workers, how much we're seeing today in youth unemployment, long-term unemployment, idle middle-aged men not even looking for work, sluggish wage increases, all that stuff. How much is a long-term trend, and how much can be undone once the world economy heals? As John Itzi said, for the Fed, the big issue now is how quickly the job market is healing, and thus, how soon should the Fed begin to move interest rates up? You know, it's been keeping interest rates at zero since December 2008, and the signals are they're going to stay there at least until the middle of next year.
You know, you mentioned wage increases being sluggish. I mean, even in an economy, that sounds like something the Fed would be worried about. Is there anything the Fed can do to actually help in terms of wages?
Well, you're right. The Fed is worried about it. Janet Yellen has talked about it. The Fed tracks wage trends closely, in part because they're an important inflation indicator, but they're also a reflection of how close the economy is to full capacity. And also, in a well-functioning economy, wages should be rising, particularly when productivity is going up. And the latest government data show average hourly earnings adjusted for inflation have not increased at all in the last year, even though we're told the economy is getting better and other wage measures show similar trends. Now, the Fed really can't do anything to get wages up. What it can do is wait to raise interest rates until the job market's healthier, and that's what they're debating now. Should they wait a while longer, or some people are getting restless?
David, this is the kind of place where I could imagine people, you know, enjoying the outdoors and golfing and having drinks and dinner, but a lot of actually substantive conversation going on at those things.
That's right. The cocktail parties and the hiking and golf, people do talk about stuff. I think what they're going to be talking about is how soon will the Fed raise interest rates, and are the people who want to raise them sooner getting traction inside the Fed's policy committee? But I'll bet much of the conversation will be about Europe. When the Bank of England will raise interest rates, they're going to probably move before the Fed. And how sick is the European banking system, and what can the European Central Bank do to get their Eurozone economy back on track? They're really having a hard time, and they're suffering a lot from the sanctions imposed on and by Russia in connection with the Ukraine.
All right. We've been speaking with David Wessel. He's director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution, also a contributor at the Wall Street Journal. David, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
With the Dow Jones Industrial Average going over 17,000 today, with housing starts up and unemployment claims down, The Federal Reserve is facing some familiar questions at its Monetary Policy Symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Is it time to back off the policy of monetary stimulus, which has held the Fed's benchmark interest rates near 0% for almost 6 years? And have those very low interest rates made fixed interest securities, bonds, so unattractive that investors have put too much money into equity stocks? In other words, is that 17,000 Dow evidence of a bubble and an omen of bad things to come, or is it confirmation of a stronger economy in which companies are earning more money, which naturally pushes up the value of their stocks? Well, we're going to put those questions now to Alan Blinder, professor of economics at Princeton, who is a former vice chairman of the Board of Governors of the Fed, and he is in Jackson Hole. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you, Robert.
Are equities now in a bubble?
Well, you know, a lot of people are asking that question, and the truth is nobody knows. I mean, some of this is surely due to the super low interest rates, which can't last forever, although they will, I believe, last for a little while longer. And part of it is definitely due to the performance of U.S. companies. As we all know, profits are way up, and the stock market's supposed to be discounting profits. And so it's not very surprising that it's high right now.
But bubbles burst. I mean, would you be astonished if one day the Dow dropped by, 1,000 points?
1,000, I'd be astounded. I would be astounded. But if it dropped 350 in a day, I wouldn't be. Nor would I be alarmed. I mean, stock markets do trend upward over long periods of time, but there are dips for sure. I guess I would call attention, as Janet Yellen did in the testimony the other day, there is a corner of the stock market, at least to me, looks very bubbly, but maybe it's because I'm an old guy, and that's some of these tech stocks.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say that the voices calling for the Fed to change course prevail sometime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Would the Fed be able to sell off all of those treasury bonds it's been buying for years in some kind of gradual, orderly way, or is the exit strategy terra incognita and potentially a very difficult time?
It is technically terra incognita. The Fed has never had a portfolio anything remotely close to this size. But I don't think it's that complicated. Think about how the Fed got all these assets. How did it get them? Well, it went out in the open market and it bought them. So when it decides it needs to unload large amounts, and that time is not with us yet, by the way, but when it does, the Fed's going to go out there and sell. So, you know, I think a reasonable way to think of it is doing in reverse what they've already done.
Well, they've been doing it for several years. Does that
mean
they'd be doing the other for several years?
They may take several years. You know, actually, the Fed party line, to which I don't subscribe, is they won't have to sell any at all, that it'll just run off by natural maturity. You know, two-year bonds take 2 years, and then they pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fed is claiming that that'll be enough, and they won't actually have to go actively selling. I frankly don't believe that, but I don't think they're going to be selling $1 trillion in a short period of time.
I'm just curious, when you say that now is not the time, this is not the time that the Fed is going to reverse course, what are the indicators out there? What are the numbers that make it so clear to Janet Yellen and to you as well that this is not the time?
Well, I think you start, as Janet Yellen always does, by looking at the labor market. And we've got a 6.2% unemployment rate, which is a lot better than it was, but still high. Secondly, you look at the GDP, and while we had a nice quarter the last quarter, we had a horrific quarter the previous quarter. In the first half of this year, we had very, very slow growth. You look at the rate of inflation, you look at the rate of wage increases, and they're all turning up a bit, but not dramatically, and in particular, the inflation measure that the Fed favors is still well below the Fed's target.
Professor Blinder, thank you very much for talking with us.
You are welcome.
It's Alan Blinder of Princeton University, who is in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where the Federal Reserve's Monetary Policy Symposium is about to begin.